way.
Okay, well, thank you, and it's a real pleasure to be here, not just for the conference, but also the sprint and workshop. In this talk, I'd like to give you my perspective on some of the observations that have been made over the past few years that seem to point to disequilibrium in the galactic disk. So just to set the stage, there are now a wide range of these observations that point to a disk in disequilibrium. In the outer disk, we have the warp and flaring of the H1 disk, something I think we'll hear about later in Sukanya's talk. There's evidence that the stellar disk has been kicked up to high galactic latitudes, something that Adrian and others and Catherine Johnston's group have worked on that echoes earlier work on kicked up disk stars in M31 and M33. And then disk corrugations from Zhu, Newberg, and company using Sloan data. But in this talk, for the most part, I'll focus on the observations in the solar neighborhood, and we'll go through those in some detail. What I like about this problem is that it really allows us to mix all of the different tools that we have used to study these types of problems, everything from theory and the competition between phase mixing and secular evolution, something that we heard about yesterday in Christoph's talk, observations and simulations and connecting them with mock data catalogs, and then some ideas from data science which can allow us to perhaps dig out more from both the observations and simulations. And so we get to bring all of these things together, and what I think is especially exciting about this problem is that we still seem to be in the early days. I think there's a lot more discovery potential, not only with Gaia DDR2, but with the third and fourth data releases that are due out over the next few years. Simulations, I think, still lag in resolution from what we're seeing in the observations, but are actually starting to reach the high end of the stellar mass function, so that's interesting. And I think we're still learning our way through the data science literature and seeing what there is there that might be useful for our problems. But in some sense, the problems that we're looking at today are old problems. And I think there are two interesting threads in understanding disequilibria. So one involves the study of bars, spiral structure, and warps, and the idea that we can look at modes of a disk, for example, bending modes in the disk, the beautiful linear theory analysis of Hunter and Toomray, and then Spark and Casertano, and then the ideas of how to understand spiral structure from swing amplification as a conspiracy of self-gravity and epicyclic motion. I think the second thread involves disk heating, so beginning with Chandrasekhar's classical work on dynamical friction, the idea of how black holes heat up the disk from Lacey and Ostreicher and others, and then the resonant coupling of a satellite as it passes through the disk by Selwood, Nelson, and Tremaine. And here's a simulation that they did by dropping a satellite, or I think it was just an external potential, plunging along the symmetry axis of the disk, and you can see that it excites the disk and creates these waves, and eventually these waves mix and leave us with a warmer, thicker disk. And so the takeaway is that the phenomena that we're observing today are really the early stages of a disk heating event, what happens before the phase mixing sets in. So here's a rough outline of the talk. I'll begin with a brief and incomplete observational overview, talk about some plausible scenarios for how the different phenomena in the disk came to be, discuss a relationship between the different observations. So are we viewing the same perturbations of the distribution function from just different angles in phase space, if you like? Talk about the physics of phase space spirals, and along the way mention a couple of methods that my students and I have found potentially useful for studying both simulations and the data. So one of the simplest things you can do is plot the number of stars in the solar neighborhood as a function of distance from the galactic midplane. This is something that my collaborators and I did with Segway data, but now the most detailed work has been done by Bennett and Bovey, where they actually take different bins in the color magnitude diagram. So they step through the color magnitude diagram along the main sequence. They plot the number density of stars as a function of distance from the galactic midplane. And then you can analyze this in two different ways. As you step through, you get different reaches in Z, but as you step through, you can either take this and try to fit an equilibrium model, say two-component model, for the thin and thick disk, and look at the residuals, and you see this little wave-like feature in the residuals. Or you can compute a model-independent north-south asymmetry parameter by taking north or above the disk minus below the disk over the sum, and again, you see this wave-like feature. And something that varies as you vary our position with respect to the midplane, but can't be eliminated by fitting that parameter. So that's the zeroth moment of the distribution function. You can look at the first moment of the distribution function, the first velocity moments of the distribution function. So for example, you can plot mean v phi in the rz plane. And so this tells you something about the mean circular motion of stars around the galactic center. As you move away from the galactic midplane, you go to warmer populations, and so the effects of asymmetric drift become greater. And so that's all contained in that figure. If you look at mean vz as a function of z and r, then you find evidence, perhaps evidence, that the disk is undergoing either bending or breathing type motions. That is, that above and below the midplane, the disk can be moving both up, or here there seems to be a region where the disk is moving away from the galactic midplane, both north and south of the midplane. And one can play the same game in the disk plane. So in the XY plane, you can look at the motions of stars. And we can now do this in exquisite detail using Gaia DR2. And you find a rather complex motion in the plane of the galaxy, in the galactocentric radial and azimuthal directions, and also in the vertical directions. So you might interpret these as motions around spiral arms. And here, perhaps, we're seeing some evidence for bending of the disk. So then we come to the famous, now famous, space-based spirals. Here, one is looking at selecting stars in an arc at roughly the same galactocentric radius of about 8 degrees in galactocentric azimuth, and then plotting the stars in the ZVZ plane. And you can see here a faint spiral-like pattern. Shervin showed us yesterday that if you cut on angular momentum, then actually the density spirals pop out in much greater detail. But you can also color the stars in galactocentric VR or VFi, and then these spirals pop out. And so this is, I think, been one of the most intriguing results from DR2. One can also look at other ways of projecting or averaging the data. So I think we'll hear a little bit more about this later today. Schoenrich and Denon looked at mean VZ or W as a function of LZ, where LZ is really a proxy for, or is related to the guiding radius, so it's a proxy for radius. And there was quite a vigorous discussion last week of whether we should call this LZ or J5. So you can leave that for the questions. But in any case, when one does this, one finds both a linear trend and wave-like motion. The linear trend is interpreted as the warp extending into the solar neighborhood, and then there's this interesting wave-like feature. And so I think along similar lines, as Shervin showed yesterday, one can look at the RV5 plane, and one sees these ridges in density, and then the ridges pop out if you instead plot mean VZ or VR. So these are just different ways of projecting out on the distribution function. So what could drive all this? Well, a natural place to look is the idea that the satellites or dark matter substructure can provoke perturbations in the disk. And for just as an illustration of how this might work, I like to turn to a simulation that a graduate student of John Dubinsky's, Jean-René Gauthier, John and I did many years ago, but it was essentially an M31 model, a relatively light disk that was stable against the formation of bar in the absence of halo substructure. And we turned 10% of a smooth halo into 100 subhalos with some subhalo mass function. And so here's the simulation. You can see the substructure coming in through the disk, launching a spiral structure. I don't want to show the whole movie, but I'll jump ahead a little if I can find the cursor. But what was interesting was that this substructure actually formed a bar in a galaxy that appeared to be stable to the formation of bars. But then we turned the viewpoint to an edge-on view of the galaxy, and it's quite clear that as this substructure passes through the disk is going to oscillate and wiggle around, and you see all sorts of interesting phenomena. So it's not surprising that if we live in a clumpy halo, then indeed we do, we will have kinematic structures in the disk.
How heavy is that disk?
Everything's live.
Yeah, but I see.
So I forget exactly, but it's definitely submaximal. So you know, it's v total squared over v disk squared was quite large, 2 or 3 or so. You know, so this thing would not have formed a bar on its own. I guess that's the point. I could show you the rotation curve.
Like.
Yeah. So then people turn to more concrete examples, and a likely culprit of all of the dark matter, what could be perturbing the disk was the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy. This really began with work by Purcell, who showed that Sagittarius coming through the disk could actually lead to spiral structure in a bar, similar to what we see. Those simulations were reanalyzed by Facundo Gomez, who found the vertical waves in the number count asymmetry that was seen in the Segway data. And then now the most detailed work has been done by Shervin and Catherine and their group, which shows that a whole range of observations can be explained by multiple passages of Sagittarius through the disk of the galaxy. So I think all this leads to a number of open questions. First, how are the different phase-space structures related? In what cases are we looking at the same distribution function structure from different angles in 6 dimensions? Do we live in a special galaxy, one in which there's a Sagittarius-like dwarf at a special time or a special place in the disk? Or are the structures that we're seeing generic to stellar disks and clumpy triaxial time-dependent halos? And what do the phase-space structures tell us about the disk, and what do they tell us about the perturbers? Are we learning something about the galaxy or the environment in which it lives? So clearly the thing that we're interested in, all this revolves around, is the distribution function. One then takes the distribution function and computes some observable one of these projections that we've been looking at by doing some integral over the distribution function with some selection function and multiplied by some function of the phase-space coordinates, which gives us the different maps that we've been looking at. So for example, you take the distribution function, you can look at an arc in galactocentric R, integrate over phi, vr, and vphi, and get the phase-space spirals, the zvz plot, that shows these phase-space spirals. You can integrate again over vz and get the number count asymmetries that we're seeing. You can multiply by vz and get bulk motions of vz, say, as a function of z and r. And so the different games that one can play in this way, but all starting with the distribution function. So likewise, you can take the r vphi plots from Laporte et al., average over curves of constant LZ, and that essentially is what's seen in the Schoenrich and Denon W versus LZ. So again, these things are all related. And I had this idea of trying to connect all of these different observations in one complicated plot, but instead I came up with this, thanks to Gary Larson, that here we are, the blindfolded blindfolded scientist trying to understand the distribution function from different directions. So what are the ingredients that we need to explain the phase-space spirals? How can we understand these spirals that we see in v phi as a function of z vz? This was something that I did with graduate student Keir Darling, but there are, I think, a somewhat different take on this by Binney and Schonrich. But in our picture, we considered a mixture of angular momenta at the position of the sun. Stars with different angular momenta separate out in vertical energy, and so this just follows from basic galactic dynamics. Here we considered two populations, each with essentially a delta function in J phi. So one population with high J phi spends most of its time at larger galactocentric radius, the one with lower J phi at smaller galactocentric radius. But at the position of the sun, you get a mixture of the two populations. Since the stars at high J phi spend more of their time in the outer part of the disk where the surface density is smaller, their vertical energy on average is smaller. And so these two populations separate out in a ZVZ plane. This is all in equilibrium. EZ essentially correlates with J phi. In addition, if you then perturb the system in Z or VZ, that is, if you displace the equilibrium position, and if the vertical potential is anharmonic, which in general it is, then the stars with high EZ will rotate more slowly in the ZVZ plane, and that's what's going to create the spirals. But it seems that to really understand the morphology of the spirals in these different pictures, one also has to think about the higher order terms and the effective potential. And this is something that I think deserves more attention, but if we combine all of these different spirals, we should be able to learn something about the galactic potential. If you like a Taylor series of the galactic potential, that includes not only the epicycle terms, but higher order terms, the R, Z squared terms, Z to the fourth terms, and so forth. In addition, we wanted to study the importance of self-gravity, and so we considered a disk in which we perturbed it by tilting a ring at the solar circle. And so here's a simulation that we ran in which we just did the most naive thing possible. We just tilted a ring at the solar circle, so one part of the ring tips down, the other part tips up, and we let the system go. In the top row of panels, we follow this perturbation in a fully self-gravitating simulation, so a fully live disk and halo. In the bottom, we follow just test particles. We do something which is a little bit dubious for galactic dynamic simulations. That is, we flooded a ring at the position of the sun with low-mass particles to get higher phase space resolution. But of course, your high-mass particles are going to diffuse into this region, creating some granularity in the potential. And in any case, one of the most interesting things that we found is that the fully live disk and halo, the one with self-gravity, the vertical bending of the disk is much more pronounced and persists for much longer than in the test particle case. Essentially, this bending just phase mixes away in just a few dynamical times. This light ring here is due to the fact that here, everything that you see is just noise from the simulation, and the noise is much less where we flooded the disk with low-mass particles. Then we then turned to the phase-space spirals and tried to compare the spirals in the live disk case and the test particle case. Again, we're always fighting the problem of resolution when you're looking at these phase-space spirals. Clearly, the spirals are cleaner, more clearly delineated in the test particle case, as you would expect, since there's so many perturbations in the live case. But it also looks at like the time scale for the wrapping is slower in the live case. So the self-gravity is affecting the evolution of these spirals. Q in this case, so I don't have Q offhand. It's certainly much greater than one. We picked, again, we picked a model that did not form a bar. So we tuned things like Q and the self-gravity of the disk. So there were most of the structure in the disk seemed to come from the perturbation that we put in. So it was a pretty quiet disk. I'd have to go back actually to the simulations themselves. So there was spiral structure, no bar, and then this big warp-like perturbation that we put in. So I think the zeroth order problem is to find a suitable description for the perturbed distribution function. And there really, I think there are two frameworks that one can operate in. One is that it's all phase mixing. If we want to understand the phase space spirals, then it's phase mixing. In that case, then we can take this Lagrangian viewpoint, essentially that the distribution function today is just the distribution function before some perturbation, and we just have to understand the mapping of phase space points after the perturbation after the disk is first perturbed until the present epoch. And so we get perfect memory of the initial perturbation and the unperturbed disk if this is indeed what is going on. And so the way you might imagine doing this is you take some initial distribution function here, just a 1D example, perturb it, watch it phase wrap, and then you can make the various projections like a number count asymmetry and this asymmetry parameter. On the other hand, if the disk is self-gravitating, then we should think about modes of the disk. And here I go back to some beautiful work by Mather and Weinberg in which they found discrete modes of a self-gravitating slab. And so if one could set up, in this case, just a 1D example, if you could set up the distribution function with this perturbation, then the ZVZ pattern would just rotate without phase mixing in a perfect eternal mode of the system. And so if it's modal decomposition, then one might imagine taking a distribution function, writing it as an equilibrium distribution, adding some perturbation, doing perhaps a Fourier analysis of that perturbation, and this goes back to early work by Selwood and Athanasula in the study of spiral structure and bars, and you can decompose this then in terms of azimuthal mode number and frequency and get some spectral distribution and understand the how things like spiral structure develop. And so my graduate student, Matt Checkers, and I extended this to bending waves, and so we could look at the bending waves in exactly the same formalism. Here, the spectral power for the bending waves lies outside the Limbad resonance as predicted by linear theory. And so it seems like this linear theory analysis works quite well for understanding things like bending of the disk. So for the Zhu and Newberg picture, I think this is probably the important and perhaps even correct way of thinking about the problem. In general, though, we should expect a mixture of phase mixing and modal oscillation. So as Christoph put it, the difference between weather and climate. And in general, if you have a perturbation, it can excite both these discrete modes and modes in the continuum, and it's the power in the continuum that leads to phase mixing and the discrete mode that leads to much longer oscillations. And so in general, you get some combination of the two. In fact, Weinberg tried to set up a system in a perfect discrete mode and was more or less unsuccessful, essentially, because power was always leaking into the continuum of modes in the system. And so this suggests that a real disks have features described by some mixture of modes and phase mixing. And we need to understand both of these, the weather and the climate, in order to understand what's going on in the disk of the Milky Way. So to explore the competition for this, again, my graduate student and I looked at just a simple 1D example where we took just a slab, but in this case we had a tunable parameter that changes whether we're looking at test particles in an external potential that keeps in an equilibrium or a perfect self-gravitating system. And so you can see here a sort of phase mixing of the test particle case and something that might correspond to sort of a disk that's sloshing around in the self-gravitating disk once it's been perturbed. For that, we've turned to a technique that we think might be very useful for analyzing simulations in general called dynamic mode decomposition. It's a method that can be used in simulations to essentially learn the modes of a complex system, essentially by throwing out physics and taking the snapshots of the simulation and trying to discover what operator or matrix takes us from one time step to the next. So in a sense, rather than trying to put physics into the simulation, learn what the dominant modes of the simulation are. Dynamic mode decomposition has its roots in computational fluid dynamics. It's now being used quite widely in data science. So if you Google it, you get all of these images. Here's this beautiful spiral pattern, which came from a paper on cyclic behavior of the stock market, of all things. But I think the go-to example for DMD is, in fact, flows around the turbulent flows around an obstruction at high Reynolds number. And so it seems to be useful for understanding what are the dominant terms in a system like this. And so in the case of these either self-gravitating or test particle simulations, we can apply the same techniques and learn things like the different discrete modes from the Weinberg style analysis or the phase space windings that we see in test particles. And so this one technique seems to be able to capture all of this and understand which modes are long-lived and which modes damp away rapidly. This seems to be a nice framework for understanding things like spiral structure. So I could easily imagine applying this to the surface density maps that would come in a simulation to study spiral structure. It might provide a way of understanding the modes, not by by dividing them into different azimuthal mode number, but combining those and seeing what are the dominant terms. And so finally, let me just mention an idea that we have for understanding the stellar velocity field. The standard method for looking at the velocity field involves slicing and binning phase space. So in the Katz et al. Paper from Gaia DR2 on kinematics, one took 200 stars within 200 parsecs of the midplane in X and Y and computed mean VR, Vphi, and Vz. And in fact, if you go through the paper, there are something like 50 different slices and cuts through the velocity field. It's difficult in these cases to understand what the uncertainties are and what the covariance is between the different maps, but one's just getting different pictures of how this is done. It seems that there are other techniques that one can apply, such as kernel density estimation and so forth. We've looked at kernel Gaussian process regression, which is a way of building a smooth differentiable model for the three-dimensional velocity field using all of the data. And then once you've built this model, you can then make any map that you like and calculate the uncertainties in the map. So here, for example, is the velocity flow in the XY plane colored by the motion normal to the plane. Here's the RZ plane. One of the interesting things, I think, useful things about this method is that it produces a differentiable model for the velocity field. And so you can calculate any derivative you like. You can calculate the divergence of the velocity field in the XY plane, which through the continuity equation is related to the time derivative of the density. So it gives us another handle on disk disequilibrium. And in principle, if one had a selection function, one could go on and apply this to the full distribution function and think about the Jeans equation or higher moments of the collision, Jeans equation or collisionless Boltzmann equation. And you can even go on and calculate work constants. So you take this model that you've built from all of the data and then ask what are the components of the velocity in the solar neighborhood and go through and calculate the generalized nine first terms of a linear expansion of the velocity field at the position of the sun. Okay, so to summarize, there's a wide range of observations in the vicinity of the sun and beyond that point to a stellar disk in a state of disequilibrium. The hope is that by studying this phenomenon, we can learn something about the structure of the disk and its environment. We have attractive phenomenological models that can reproduce these observations, but I think we still lack a coherent picture of what the underlying distribution function is, how to describe a perturbed DF, and how what physics could take us from, in an idealized case, an equilibrium DF to the perturbed one. And the hope is that by combining more observations, theory, and simulations, and perhaps a few ideas from data science, we can get a more complete understanding of disk dynamics. Thanks.
Thank you. First question from Heidi.
Hi, Larry. So you're the person who came up with the term galactoseismology, yes? And in your talk, you've mostly been talking about using the phase space to determine properties of disks. Does that mean that you're kind of moving away from this being a possibility that we would use it for substructure, or is that?
I think that's still a key question. So, you know, the simulations that Shervin showed are really attractive, that we're learning, you know, perhaps we're learning something about Sagittarius and its orbit, and we can time the orbit. It's not clear to me that there are not just other perturbations that you do to the disk that will give the same you know, sort of winding in the solar neighborhood. But it may be that the different observations split in sort of early time phase mixing and late time secular evolutions, borrow something from Christoph's talk. And so maybe that things like phase space spirals do wrap up rapidly and they tell you about some recent event in the disk. I would think, my guess is that the corrugation of the disk may be more of a long time behavior of the disk that's been perturbed by multiple passages of substructure, and perhaps you're seeing sort of the dominant oscillations of the disk. So maybe that different observations are going to tell you about either early or late time, you know, behavior. So maybe a combination of the two. But I think that's just still the big question.
Next question, Sukanya.
Thanks, Rosie. So that was really nice. I'm trying to understand the level of self-gravity at which, so as you showed, the test particle representation gives you a very clean view of the phase space spiral. At what point does it, you know, what level of self-gravity prohibits this? Because I imagine that the inner disk is self-gravitating, right?
Right. And I guess it may depend on what exactly the disk is doing. So it seems like the phase space spirals, the self-gravitating case was, you know, the actual evolution in detail was somewhat different in our case than in the test particle case. But the most dramatic effect of self-gravity was in the actual bending waves of the disk. So that's why I was saying that the corrugation, I think, you know, it really is self-gravity. I would say it really must be these sort of Hunter Tumray waves rippling through the disk. The spirals in the local phase space seem like, I mean, it just seems more like phase mixing, but self-gravity perhaps is important in allowing these things to persist a bit longer. But yeah.
Next question here.
I was curious about the bar formation through interactions with subhalos. Did you track the spin evolution of the bar in those simulations? And also, did you look at whether or not you could produce an X-shaped boxy bar viewed X-shaped?
So in the original Gautier, in those simulations, we form a bar. It buckles edge on. I think it's if you look at the simulations edge on, you see the boxy shape. You can see evident, you know, clear signatures of the bar. If you look at the velocity flows around the bar slows down due to its interaction with the rest of the disk and the dark matter halo. So, and I think the pattern speeds were all sort of typical of pattern speeds that we expect for the galactic bar.
So there's no instance of it being spun up ever by these subsequent interactions?
We didn't see that. I think so one thing I should add, after that initial simulation that we did, John and his student ran a suite of 10 simulations, and the interesting thing we found there was that the time of formation of the bar could vary from essentially 1 to infinity, you know, 1 to greater than 10 gigayears. And so whether or not this bar-stable disk would form a bar with substructure depended on the details of the random number, you know, of the substructure distribution. And in that simulation, it seems like there's one subhalo that comes through the center of the disk and excites the bar.
Next question, Jerry Sold. Coming back to the point that Sukanya made about the difference between the self-gravity simulations, the evolution of the phase-based spiral, and self-gravity and test particle simulations.
Yeah.
One has to worry about the possibility that two-body relaxation is just messing up the spiral.
Yeah.
That's a very sensitive, the evolution of the spiral will be very sensitive to questions like that.
Yeah.
And we know that, that relaxation in disks, because the motion is coherent all in the same direction, about 10,000 times faster than in the spherical system.
Yeah.
So you have to, I don't know how many particles you're using, but that's a concern.
Right. So that's where our, this dubious procedure that we tried of having, we wanted to do a simulation with just a few million particles, but we needed more resolution in the solar neighborhood. And so we tried making a sort of fat ring around the perturbation of high resolution particles. Of course, the low mass, the low resolution particles are going to diffuse in and create some perturbations and introduce some relaxation there. So that it's certainly a problem. I mean, what I think would be interesting is to repeat this experiment with one of these very high resolution simulations that allow you to go up to, to achieve that resolution, but throughout the whole disk. Test the self-gravitating case, do a resolution study in the self-gravitating case, which we did a bit of. And, in general, I think these results were robust to different resolutions, but I think, you're right, we need to study that further. Yeah.
So, great talk. I have very similar thought to Jerry, actually.
Yeah.
Whether the phase-space spiral is wrapping slower or is it fuzzing because of scattering, whether it's numerical or physical. And I think it's interesting to understand the difference, as you're suggesting, because then it helps us with interpretation. And the other question was, related to this as well, a third interpretation. We've been talking for 2 weeks, and I feel like I haven't been listening, so I'm listening again. Our third interpretation is that the spiral is being reset by self-perturbation, which is... So I think if we could sort those three out, it would really help us in understanding how much history there is encoded in there.
Right,
I think Jerry's point about numerical relaxation is, it's another form of saying scattering, right?
So that's right, yeah.
So you made this interesting observation that you need coupling between R and Z to properly explain the phase-space spirals. And I was wondering, when you were expanding in the effective potential, if you just have the next order term, is that sufficient to explain the data? Or do you actually see in the data evidence for the effects of still higher order terms in the Taylor expansion? And I also wanted to know whether there was any effect if you broke Z goes to minus Z symmetry in the Taylor expansion.
So in our Taylor expansion, we assumed Z minus Z symmetry. So the next order term is RZ squared. And that one certainly changes the morphology of the spirals, when you plot things like mean VR and mean V5. Exactly what you're digging out of the data, I think, we'd have to go... Well, we haven't done that exercise, so it's clearly affecting the morphology of the spirals. It seems that there are features of the spirals, the way that the these mean velocities change as you go perpendicular to the spiral ridges is consistent with these higher order terms. But to actually dig out things like the coefficients of those expansions, I think would certainly require more detailed study. So it seemed, in what we did, we just looked at the R squared, the R Z squared term. You then go to R squared, Z squared, and Z to the four, the Z to the fourth term is clearly important. Then you have R cubed and so forth. And you could ask, what all these terms mean. And I think those must be connected with these generalized Oort constants, as well. And so somehow, perhaps a spiral can give us some handle on what's going, on what the potential looks like at higher order.
Yep. Rick Colbert.
So on your weather climate theme, and so yesterday we heard from the fire simulations that they had a lot of bars that came and went, which maybe are these ones that are induced, but there was, the disk wasn't very strongly self-gravitating and had a lot of gas clouds that would probably mess up orbits, whereas probably the R&R galaxy is, we're stuck with it, right? It's a big, coherent, heavy thing. So I'm curious what your views are on bars in other galaxies, in the real universe. Are they mostly robust bars, or are they this transient weather bars?
Well, we have far more bar experts in the audience, so you put me on the spot. In just my line of sight, it's just. Right. We see roughly a third galaxies have no bar that we can observe. A third have weak bars, and a third are massive strong bars, and so whether the galaxies that we're seeing that don't have bars are the ones in which there was some transient bar that then buckled and formed a bulge or so forth, I guess is an open question. But Orwin.
So there are many massive bars, of course, and it's very hard to imagine that they get destroyed easily. There's always the question about the age of the stars and the age of the bar. But in M31, the age of the stars and the Bopsy bulge, the 3D bar, is just 1 giga-year less than in the very center in the classical bulge. So this stuff has been around for a long time. Even perhaps it's been excited 2 or 3 giga-years, so we wouldn't know.
What's that?
Is it a question on bars?
Yes.
I think you need to.
Wait for the microphone, please.
Ray referred to what we were doing in the simulations, and we have, just because the bar is transient in some of the simulations doesn't mean that it's not big when it's there. So we have one case that Victor De Battista and I looked into with one of his students, and while the bar is there in the simulation, it's a big thing. It's just that then it buckles and forms a X-shaped bulge, and that process in that particular galaxy happens closer to the configuration is younger than we think the Milky Way is, based on comparisons between the ages and metallicities and dynamics of the stars in that simulation versus the Milky Way. But it's not like the bar is less strong when it exists because it's transient. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind here.
Okay, thanks. Question, Vasily?
So as you keep bombarding the disk with subhalos, so do you see any significant or dramatic evolution of the spin of the disk, or is it just shakes and wobbles? Or
In the spin, the rotation curve of the disk? Thinking, so there have been different simulations that we've run. I think in the original simulation, I think that there's some, certainly when the bar forms is probably the biggest effect that one has on the evolution of the disk. So it's actually the substructure heats the disk, but the bar is the thing that is the dominant heating mechanism, and also the dominant mechanism that I think changes features in the rotation curve. So it's the substructure excites the bar, but the bar has the largest effect in sort of the global structure of the disk.
Can you misalign it? I mean, can we do anything, or is it just the mass function that you use?
So that, I mean, that question of misalignment actually reminds me of something that I'm doing with a current student, Jake, in fact. Mm-hmm. In the Gautier et al. Simulation, we see very little evidence for kicked up stars. And so that disk is staying very much in its original configuration. If, on the other hand, if we look at disks in cosmological halos, Rho disk in a cosmological halo, then you see much more evidence of misalignment, much more evidence for kicked up disk stars and warps and so forth. And so just turning part of the halo into substructure can excite the bar and can excite things in the plane, but doesn't produce the high B features that we see in the Milky Way. So it seems to be more than just substructure.
Well, let's thank Larry again.